From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Played at Arlington National Cemetery this morning in Arlington, Virginia, to mark the 50th anniversary of the day President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas. We'll have the news of today, but we're also going to follow the timeline of this day 50 years ago as it happened.
I think we just heard in those taps the same sort of hesitation that happened 50 years ago when taps were played at Kennedy's funeral. And at this hour in 1963, President Kennedy was still in Fort Worth, Texas. He would soon board Air Force One for Dallas, which today is holding its first ever city-sponsored commemoration in Dealey Plaza. The city has a complicated relationship with this day. 50 years ago, businessmen from Dallas were thrown out of cabs in New York. Hate mail arrived by the bagful from around the world. Even though Kennedy's killer, Lee Harvey Oswald, was a Marxist drifter who rather liked Kennedy's push for civil rights. Lauren Silverman is a reporter with KERA in Dallas. She's in Dealey Plaza. Lauren, we know an event is coming up, but what are you seeing now?
Well, the crowds here are gathering and huddling as close as possible. It is freezing out. I think the high today is 42, so everyone is waiting for the event to begin in Dealey Plaza, where the assassination occurred.
Well, we know there were 5,000 tickets given out through a lottery. 13,000 people, though, really wanted them. What is the sense of people there? Do they want to participate in this day and embrace it? Do they want it to pass quickly because of the shadow on their city? What's the sense you get?
Well, I talked to a few women this morning, and most of the people here are either big history buffs, if they weren't alive when 50 years ago, or they have a very distinct memory of where they were when the assassination happened, and as one woman put it to me, wanted to come full circle back to this moment today here in Dallas when it happened, and wants to see the city come around and recognize the history of it, and finally, as you said, for the first time, have an event in memory of John F. Kennedy.
Well, we know the city's also been a magnet for tourists from around the world, for conspiracy theorists who put marks on the ground where bullets are believed to have struck the president. Those marks were removed this week, but it's awkward. You know, a city is both attraction and reminder. Give us more of a sense of the city's complicated history.
Yeah, so the city has a very complicated history with what happened here. And for many years, the city in some ways didn't want to open the wound that was November 22nd, 1963. So much like they paved over those X's that were in the sidewalk, they sort of swept what happened under the rug. And this is the first time that people are coming to terms in a way with what happened. Back in 1963, you have to remember, Dallas looked a lot different than it does today. It was a divided city. It was a Republican city. It was 75% white. Right now, the population is 42% Hispanic. So it was also, the schools were not integrated yet. So things looked very different here in 63, and people welcomed Kennedy, but there was also leaders who were loud and vocal opponents of the change that he was trying to push through.
Yeah, we mentioned the city received hate mail after the assassination, but also the mayor received hate mail before. As you said, some people were not happy that Kennedy was coming. And let's just listen. In the days after the assassination, then-Dallas Mayor Earl Cobble, who rode in the presidential motorcade, spoke about what kind of legacy he thought Dallas would have after the assassination.
I don't think that this will hurt Dallas as a city, because I believe that the people of the nation realize that this was not an act of Dallas, not an act of the true thinking of Dallas. This was the act of a maniac.
Well, he might have been right in the long run, but Lauren, as you know, not in the short run, because, you know, people would send mail addressed to you people who kill the president in Texas, and it would go to Dallas.
Yeah, I mean, he, in the short term, definitely was hopeful and optimistic, and overly so, because the scar that was left on the city of Dallas, not only on the city, but on people who were afraid to say that they were even from Dallas when they would travel around, even around the world, because it was seen as horrible, evil place. So in the short term, it wasn't seen that way, and the city's worked hard to try and change that perception, you know, with the Cowboys and with the show Dallas, and there's been various reincarnations of the city that are still continuing. And but this, as you said, the mayor did receive hate letters. He received letters that accused him and other people of being complicit in this plot to kill the president or to not protect him. Maybe they didn't pull the trigger, but as one of my colleagues put it, they certainly helped to load the gun.
Yeah. Well, a part of the mayor's, well, part of Kennedy's undelivered speech will be read at the commemoration today. And as you said, hopefully a lot of healing for that city. Lauren Silverman, a reporter with NPR station KERA in Dallas, speaking to us from Dealey Plaza. Lauren, thanks so much.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Funding for Here and Now comes from GEICO, protecting drivers and their families with insurance coverage for over 75 years. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
Today we're following a timeline of events as they unfolded 50 years ago. Early that Friday, President Kennedy was in Fort Worth, Texas, getting ready to leave for Dallas and the assassin's bullet that would end his life. But in Fort Worth, Kennedy was thinking about re-election in 1964 and the 25 electoral votes he needed in Texas. He spoke to a Chamber of Commerce breakfast in Fort Worth about the struggle against communism.
This is not an easy effort. This requires sacrificed by the people of the United States. But this is a very dangerous and uncertain world. As I said earlier, on three occasions in the last 3 years, the United States has had a direct confrontation. No one can say when it will come again. No one expects that our life will be easy. Certainly not in this decade, and perhaps not in this century.
We want to know more about this moment in history, but also why it and President Kennedy had such an impact. Here's one listener's memory.
My name is Prudence Ingerman. I was in the first group to go to Bolivia with a brand new Peace Corps. I was assigned to work in a colony for people with Hansen's disease, leprosy, and was successful in starting a school and creating orthopedic sandals for those patients with problem feet, like no toes. On that November day, the five of us were sitting around relaxing, and the missionary husband, a man of great dignity and reserve, ran screaming down the hill from his house. They shot the president! They shot the president! At that time, revolutions in Bolivia were very common, so we thought nothing of it. He got closer, still yelling, "They shot the president!" We stood up politely, and then he said, "Kennedy! They shot President Kennedy! Turn on the radio!" So in shock and with some volunteers weeping, we managed to get on the Voice of America. What we were even more astonished by was the reaction of the people of Bolivia. For at least a week, every home displayed its flag, but they tied the flags back with strips of black cloth so they could not fly freely. The whole country was in mourning. We saw many people wearing black armbands. Total strangers came up to us on the street and embraced us, crying and saying, "We're so sorry about your president. We're so very sorry. He was so beloved."
Wow. Well, joining us from NPR in New York to help us think about this 50th anniversary and look back on President Kennedy's assassination is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. Julian, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And let's start with what we just heard. Why was President Kennedy so beloved?
Well, part of it was about him. He was a leader who was able to inspire a new generation of Americans, both through actual policies like the Peace Corps and through the kinds of words that he uttered at his inaugural address. And he gave a sense of possibility for the future, a new era of politics. And part of it is the fact that his presidency was unfinished. So we don't know what was going to happen. We don't know what was going to go wrong. In some ways, there wasn't time for people to become tired with him like they do with many presidents. So this unfulfilled aspect, I think, continues to inspire people because we can imagine the best.
Well, Julian, as you just said, he did inspire. We heard from so many listeners who were inspired to pick up and go to the Peace Corps or do volunteer work because of the Ask Not What You Can Do for Your Country line. And here was the youngest president following one of the country's oldest. So he did inspire young people. But as to the unfinished part, Nick Burns, writing this week, reminds us, and we just heard the president's words reminding us, there were three events: the Bay of Pigs, the failed meeting with Soviet leader Khrushchev, the Berlin crisis, things he had failed at the point that we are now in 63. He was on a sort of trajectory towards learning more. But tell us more about those moments where he was seen as foundering.
Yeah, I mean, both on foreign policy and domestic policy. In 1963, there were a lot of big questions about him as a leader. On foreign policy, the Bay of Pigs had been a huge fiasco, and many people interpret it as a sign that this president was not really capable of the big challenges. And when Nikita Khrushchev really showed him up in some ways during a meeting and was dismissive and arrogant toward him, it was a huge embarrassment toward the president. Obviously, the resolution of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 had been a real high point for him. But it wasn't yet clear that he was going to be so stellar on foreign policy. And on domestic policy, it was, a much more difficult record. Much of what he had proposed was stifled in Congress, and many people were dubious whether he could get anything, civil rights, health care, tax cut, through the legislative branch, and thought this was not a guy who understood how Washington worked and how Congress worked.
Well, you mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis. He did come to a compromise with Khrushchev. And Nick Burns, another, says he was growing wary of the lure of militarism, emphasizing peace. Emphasizing peace at home as well, making that famous speech to white Americans, asking them, do we really want to be a country where Negroes, the word used in that day, don't have the same chances we have? Put that in context as he comes to Texas.
Well, on foreign policy, it's true. He had grown weary of military advisors. He was not necessarily a peacenik, but he was much more skeptical about what the military branches were telling him and much more willing to push back. His big step on civil rights was finally in June. He had proposed legislation to Congress, really in response to all the pressure from the civil rights movement and just the impossibility of holding back anymore.
And they thought he was late. They thought he was very late.
They thought he was late. They weren't confident he was going to move through with this, and they were very skeptical. But when he goes to Texas, he still, for many conservatives, is a president who had finally embraced civil rights, and many conservatives tagged him as someone who was soft on communism. So he goes into a Dallas where many people are very hostile openly about who he is.
Well, that's why people thought it was the John Birch Society centered in Texas that killed him, or it was the mob, or it was his own government, or it was the military generals that he might not have been listening to as closely. The Warren Commission and the Congressional Assassination Committee all concluded it was Lee Harvey Oswald. Just give us your thoughts, closing thoughts here on what that means to Americans now. Draw the line after the assassination to our views of both violence and trusting the government.
I think in terms of violence, it is a shock that continues in the electorate, and the notion that politics can become so extreme and that a lone assassin is willing to do this, whatever your views, is the end of innocence in some ways for many Americans about politics. And the era that followed was so bitter and contentious, that is often seen as the starting point. So I think it's scarred us in many ways. It's increased our cynicism about politics, and it's exacerbated our fears about how far people are willing to go. So we live in an era where the shadow of that assassination still looms very large.
Julian and Jeremy, I'm thinking that we're hearing from a lot of listeners saying, I met Kennedy, he shook my hand, he walked right up to me without a hat. That, Julian, would be very limited from this moment on.
Impossible. The kind of motorcade that he took, that was it. Now we have a kind of insulation of the president, which physically removes them from the citizenry.
Well, Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School, thanks so much for helping us remember this day 50 years later.
Thank you.
This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Lumosity.com with web-based brain games created by neuroscientists to improve memory and attention. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Comcast Business, working to close the digital divide with its Internet Essentials program for families in need. Learn more at InternetEssentials.com.
I remember when. A familiar trio of words as we commemorate the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. But the truth is, for many of us, there is no memory because we weren't born. Sarah DiMagno is a senior at Lincoln High School in Lincoln, Nebraska. She's with us from the studios of NET Public Radio. And Sarah, you are 17 years old. Do you remember the first time you learned about Kennedy's assassination?
I think it was when I was about 7 or 8 years old, and I have to tell you that I am a self-professed space geek. So I was reading a book about the Apollo program that, you know, eventually landed astronauts on the moon, and the author was a flight director at NASA, and he was talking about, you know, when JFK was assassinated, that really affected all of the engineers on the moon mission because that had really been their goal, was to fulfill this goal that he had set.
So what did you think when you found out that the president had been shot?
I guess that when, you know, when I sort of learned about the circumstances of it, my first thing was surprise, because security, you know, that I've grown up with anywhere on the streets, in the airport, is so much tighter than what it was like during that parade in Dallas.
Yeah, you were only, 5 years old when 9/11 happened?
Yes, I was.
Wow. And since the first time you heard about JFK's assassination, in your history classes, how has he been presented?
Well, sort of the idea that I've come to have about JFK is that part of the real tragedy of his assassination was the sort of loss of potential. I mean, he was this incredible young president who had great ideas about the direction he wanted to see the country going in, and then it was just tragically cut short. And so in history classes, they really teach it as sort of how JFK was an icon, and his death was not only the death of a president, but sort of the death of a representation of the future that could have been.
I have to say, I totally agree with you. I am also too young to have been alive for the assassination, and I think it's very well put, what you have just said. As you have been witnessing all of the talk about JFK during the 50th anniversary week, does it mean anything to you?
Yeah, it means a lot to me because I also feel that sort of loss of potential, because a lot of the issues that JFK was facing, you know, advancements in technology, in space science, advancements in civil rights, are some of the same issues that we're still facing today. And you can't help but think, you know, if he had finished his presidency, you know, maybe had a second presidency, where would we be now? Would we be in a better place?
What would you say is the event in your lifetime, and as we said, you were only five when 9/11 happened, that had the same kind of impact, if anything?
I think it would be 9/11. I do actually remember 9/11, even as a five-year-old, and it's one of my first memories, which is sort of frightening. But a lot of the same things, you know, I've been reading the newspaper, and they're publishing all of these memories of, you know, where people were when JFK was assassinated. And a lot of them are very similar to the memories that I have of 9/11. You know, you walk into the kitchen and see your parents and they're upset. And then you see, you know, frightening images on the cover of the newspaper or in the news, and you don't quite understand what's happened. My experience of 9/11 is very similar to that.
And we should say also that Ted Sorensen, the famous JFK advisor, went to your high school, right?
Yes. And we hear a lot about JFK in my school because of that. And Mr. Sorensen actually came and talked to the school a few years back. So I'm sure that today will be a very big deal at Lincoln High.
Well, Sarah DiMagno, a senior at Lincoln High School in Lincoln, Nebraska, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And we've got a complete timeline of the events in 1963 at hereandnow.org. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
And we've been trying to get at the feelings of 50 years ago today. So was critic Adam Gopnik when he wrote a recent essay. What beyond the hype and the teeth, he writes, was there? Well, the answer, he says, may be in the way poets responded to the death of Kennedy. At President Kennedy's inauguration, Robert Frost, one of the country's most famous poets and one of Kennedy's favorites as well as his friend, recited from memory his poem, The Gift, outright. He said the sunshine that day in 1961 blinded him and made it impossible to read what he'd written for the occasion.
The land was ours before we were the land. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people.
Frost died several months before President Kennedy was killed, but if he'd been alive, he might again have had trouble finding the words to talk to the nation. Adam Gopnik writes about the difficulty poets had when Kennedy was assassinated. He writes this essay in The New Yorker and joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Adam, tell us more.
One of the things that was striking to me when I was reading about the literature of the assassination, and I was a small boy then, but I remember it as though it were yesterday. It's really the day when my own 6-year-old mind pivots right around from being only aware of the private, domestic universe to being acutely aware of the outer public political universe. So I remember it so keenly, and I was going back to find out what had been said by significant people. And it was very remarkable that poets as different as Robert Lowell, for instance, the great Boston-based poet, says of that weekend that he and the whole country were filled with a passionate chaos, that he wept his way through that weekend. He writes about it very movingly in a letter to Elizabeth Bishop. Randall Jarrell, one of Lowell's closest friends, tried to write an elegy for Kennedy and could get no farther than a single line, that brown head. John Berryman. We're really talking, Robin, about the big boys, so to speak, not talking about greeting card poets, but about the major poets of American post-war modernism. Were all so shook up, so stirred, so grief-stricken by Kennedy's death that they tried to articulate it. Berryman wrote a formal elegy, as he called it, for the president. W.H. Auden, the Anglo-American dean of poetry, wrote a piece in collaboration with Stravinsky. And I think that that's some kind of measure of two things, really. One, of how shaken they were by the event, but also of the way, as I write in that piece, that it was one of the last times when what you might call the highbrow imagination of America was completely invested in the dignity of the presidency.
I want to hear more about that, but first let's listen to a little of the Auden poem. As you write, there was a huge volume of poetry and power. It had a Rauschenberg silk screen portrait of the president on its cover. It came out just months after the murder. It was recorded complete on Folkways Records. Let's listen to a little of W.H. Auden's Elegy for JFK, Irene Daly, reading Auden's words.
Why then? Why there? Why thus, we cry, did he die? The heavens are silent. What he was. What he is fated to become depends on us. Remembering his death, how we choose to live will decide its meaning.
Remembering his death, how we choose to live will decide its meaning. We'll talk more about how you feel maybe Americans did choose to live after after that moment. But, you know, again, just these powerful words put together in response to the death of Kennedy. And you write that looking back now, it's easy to be cynical. He writes, cynicism is a new branch of American historical studies. But to think that this was just writers and poets in the thrall of Jackie Kennedy being invited to the White House. But you don't think it was that?
I don't think it was that. It's certainly true that the Kennedys, and Jackie in particular, was a very intelligent woman, saw that there was something to be gained by opening the doors of the White House to painters and poets, writers, in a way that they had seemed closed during the Eisenhower years. And you can question just how committed JFK was to the poetry of Robert Frost or W.H. Auden or the music of Pablo Casals. He was an extremely bright guy, but his passions were history and politics, not the upper reaches of highbrow culture. Nonetheless, I don't doubt for a moment that those people were responding sincerely. They saw that Kennedy had represented a sense of possibility, an era of hope that had come to an end.
We've heard about the Camelot era, the shining city on a hill that he was supposed to represent. As you said, the poet Randall Jarrell called his death the saddest public event that he could remember, and he tried to write an elegy but got no further than the actual. It was four words. You said the brown head, but it's the shining brown head.
The shining.
There was something about the glow of light off the hair, the head of hair that just added to all of it. And yet it was a real time when there was a fissure, a divide in people between their inner lives and this sort of conformist, repressed official life. You know, people were picking up suitcases and marching off to work after World War II. And what? This White House was maybe cleaving that a bit?
I think there are two things that are true. One is that a lot of people at the time felt that that era of conformity, of button-down fear that we associate with the Eisenhower years was coming to an end with Kennedy. Now, it's possible for us to be a bit nostalgic about that button-down conformist era now. In retrospect, maybe it doesn't look so bad. But Kennedy, for people like Norman Mailer, for instance, seemed to represent this moment of romantic and even, it sounds a little comic, but it was very deeply felt, existential possibility when all of that break between the inner life of America, which was passionate and aspiring and existential, and the outer life of America, which was so buttoned down and conformist seeming, that though that would be breached, broken by Kennedy's example. It seems to us like a very romantic idea to invest in a politician, but exactly what's interesting, I think, Robin, is that people invested romantic ideas in politicians at that moment.
Yeah.
The other thing that I'd say, and I think is the darker side of that same sense of rupture, is that after Kennedy's death, after the assassination, what did become clear is that the more sordid, even seamy underside of American life and the shining Camelot side of American life turned out to be much closer than we'd ever thought they had been. The title I gave to the essay is Closer Than That, after a line in the great film noir, Double Indemnity. And I think that part of the after effect of the assassination was exactly to make people aware of how much even someone like Kennedy was, through all of the complex intertangling of his politics and his family life, was entangled with a world of violence, of assassination, of much darker possibilities.
Well, you mentioned you were just 7 when President Kennedy was killed. Again, we're trying to get at why it was so piercing a moment. Hopefully, we will not have to ever discover again if it will be the same moment, you know. Hopefully, we'll never know. But the question is always asked, do you remember where you were?
I remember the entire weekend, almost to a spooky degree. I can remember that they first mentioned Lee Harvey Oswald's name around 4:30 on that Friday. And sure enough, when we went back and looked at the NBC tapes, that's exactly when they mentioned it. I think it was the notion of America could be embodied by a dangerously youthful character rather than by a cautiously elderly character. I think all of those things poured into it, and I think they continue to haunt some of our imaginations anyway.
Yeah. Adam Gopnik with his remembrances of November 22nd, 1963. He's also written a terrific piece in The New Yorker about the age of cynicism that it's spawned, including conspiracy theories, and how poets responded or tried to respond to the assassination. It's in The New Yorker. We'll link you at herenow.org. Adam, thanks as always.
Pleasure to talk to you, Robin.
And as we continue to follow our timeline of the events in Dallas on this day 50 years ago, we note that at this time on that day, President Kennedy's motorcade was just leaving Love Field for the trip through Dallas. From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Institute of Contemporary Art with Amy Silman, a 25-year retrospective of the artist's vivid abstract paintings and intimate drawings. ICABoston.org.